You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! My guest, Austin Channing Brown, is a writer, speaker, and practitioner who helps schools, nonprofits, and religious organizations practice genuine inclusion. Her writing has appeared in outlets like Christianity Today, Relevant, Sojourners, and The Christian Century. Her book is I'm Still Here, Black Dignity in a World Made for Whiteness. Austin, thanks for being back on the show.
Oh my goodness, thanks for having me again.
Do you remember pretty clearly when you found out the full reason why your parents named you Austin?
I do. So my mother and I were obsessed with libraries when I was a kid. And we would travel like up to 45 minutes to an hour just to get to a particular library. We loved them. And I remember going to the front to check out a book. And the librarian said to me, is this your card? And I thought, I think so. Like, I don't think I got it mixed up with anybody. Like, I think this is my card. And she said, the card says Austin. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's me. And she was like, are you sure? And I was thinking, am I sure that I'm Austin? Like, what does, I don't understand the question. And I was very used to people assuming I would be a boy because my name was Austin. But something about her suspicion just made me think, what in the world is going on? And so I marched over to my mother and was like, Ma, why did you give me this name? And she said, you know, Austin, we knew that if someone saw your name on an application for, you know, a job or for college, that they would assume that you're a white man. And she said, we just needed to get you to the interview. And I thought, wait, what? Right? I was like, okay. And she kept going. She said, now once you get to the interview, we know that you'll blow people away. We know that you'll get the job, or, you know, you'll get into any school that you want to get into. Like, you'll do amazing. And then she just repeated, but we just had to get you to the interview. And I was like, okay. Not entirely sure what to do with that. But I feel like it was my first lesson that the assumptions about my body are deeper than just gender, that there is something happening with my race that people are responding to. And that's why the woman at the front desk just like couldn't get beyond my name being Austin. It wasn't because she expected me to be a boy, it was because she was expecting me to be a white boy. And I was like, huh, well, all right then. It was strange because there were a lot of things in my life that finally made sense. And yet, because I was so young, I couldn't fully process it, right? Like that felt like a good explanation for why the librarian had responded to me that way. And yet I couldn't have explained why, if that makes any sense. It was a both and experience for sure.
And it's not like your parents' feelings weren't unfounded. I mean, there's been a lot of studies showing, you know, identical resumes that get sent in, but resumes that don't have a name that white people don't generally have will not get a callback when a stereotypical white name will.
That's right. For jobs, for renting, for homes, for, you know, for all kinds of things. And I later discovered, you know, as I was growing up, that a lot of Black folks, when they have kids, really struggle with which direction they're going to go. Are they going to go with a more white sounding name, you know, and hope that that bypasses some discrimination? Or do they go with a really Black sounding name in hopes that makes, you know, the person feel rooted and celebrated and loved, and, you know, and so, but the fact that Black families are thinking about how race and their name is going to impact their child's life, you know, no matter which direction they go, it is a very real conversation in many Black households.
Well, the other side of that is that you have gone to a bunch of interviews in which people were expecting a white guy to walk in and you walked in instead, and you've had to deal with the reactions from that.
I don't think I've ever walked into a group interview where there wasn't a reaction, where people weren't visibly surprised. And so surprised that typically someone at the table says something.
Like
someone at the table will say, I was shocked that you weren't a white man. Like I was just expecting somebody completely different, because they're so taken aback. Like it is so shocking to them. That yeah, almost always somebody said, if not during the interview, after the interview is over.
Well, I want to talk a little bit later just about the your everyday interactions you have in the professional world. But I also want to talk about your upbringing a little bit. You were last on the show about 4 years ago, and so we talked a little bit about this back then, but I want to get into some more specifics that we didn't touch then. You grew up in Akron, is that right?
I did not. I grew up in Toledo, Ohio.
I'm so sorry. Toledo.
Yeah. No, that's okay. Yeah. My dad's entire family is from Akron, so that's the Akron connection. Yeah,
right. So you grew up in predominantly white spaces.
I did. Yes. Attended all like private Christian schools growing up. So yeah, pretty, my neighborhood, I think, was also fairly white. We had a couple of Black neighbors, but yeah, every space that I was in was predominantly white growing up.
What was it like for you as a kid going to a majority white school?
You know, it was all I had ever known, so I didn't honestly think much of it. I don't know that it ever occurred to me that there was a different option and that I could, I think because my neighborhood looked like my school, that I just maybe assumed that the entire city was just predominantly white, you know, and I have no idea what the statistics were back then, but I never questioned whether or not anything else was possible. So I just accepted it as, you know, it was what it was. But I did recognize racial differences. So I remember, and like really silly stuff that kids notice. So I remember thinking, I wonder why all the white girls' ponytails swish from side to side when they walk, but like mine bounces up and down. I wonder what that's about. And then things that that I thought were race, but like weren't necessarily about race. So I remember going to like my first little sleepover, and it was a white girl, and she had a bunch of cats. And I remember thinking, I wonder why white people like cats so much. You know, like I just, you know, like this is so interesting. So yes, I was aware of race as a kid, and being around a lot of white women, white girls in particular. But it was definitely hit or miss as to whether or not things were actually racial or not. But I was definitely aware of the differences for sure.
As you got a little bit older, your parents got a divorce and you started spending the summers, I think when you were about 10, right, in Cleveland. And it seems like that was kind of the first time where you were a part of the majority from the people you were hanging around. It was in a Black neighborhood, and you went to a Black church.
It was wonderful and beautiful and hard and terrifying. I think I had only been introduced to a space where Black folks are defining the culture when I was in Akron visiting my father, visiting his family. But it was always so fast. It would be like just a couple hours or, you know, and so to be in a Black neighborhood for an entire summer was just a completely different experience, where I had to learn a new language. You know, I had to learn the slang that was popular then. I had to learn about music, contemporary music that I had never heard of before. So I knew the music that my parents listened to and that they really enjoyed, but I didn't know much about the music you know, that kids were listening to, because I went to a private white school, where nobody really knew what Black kids were listening to. And so there was a significant learning curve, for me as I tried to participate in this culture, that I had never been a part of before. And it was jolting because I knew what ways white culture was different from me, and I was fine with that. But it was jolting to be like, oh, but I don't seem to fit here either. Like, what? Where do I belong? What is happening here? And thankfully, I had a little friend who lived like four doors down who completely embraced me and changed my entire experience, by accepting me and genuinely like teaching me, like, here's the radio station you're going to listen to, and here's the dance we're going to learn. And, she was amazing. She was so amazing. But yeah, it was my first time really being in a Black majority space, and then later church, which is an entirely different culture again. But one that I fell in love with very quickly.
It sounds like before you really spent some time with that friend down the street, there was a certain amount of pain with feeling like, you know, not only did you not completely fit in with the predominantly white culture and neighborhood in Toledo, right, but not feeling like you completely fit in with the Black culture in Cleveland.
Oh, it was so hard. I remember sometimes, I would just sit in the back of the, like, the little classroom that we all occupied, and I would find the farthest table and just put my head down and just try to not engage, because it was so much work to pretend like I knew what people's jokes meant, or I knew what the references were, or I was scared to participate in like the dance competitions. I didn't know the line dances. So it was just like, it was so overwhelming. And I would sometimes make myself physically sick, because I just couldn't keep up, and it was so overwhelming and so emotional, you know, at an age when everybody wants to fit in, you know, like that's all you want is to fit in and have a friend. And I did not, good Lord, I did not. And so, yeah, it was really, really difficult at first. Yeah, until space was made for me. And it taught me so much. It taught me so much about myself and about the Black community, that I never would have learned if my only experience had been being in a predominantly white space.
Was it hard to go back after the summers were over?
No. I attended, and particularly in elementary school, I had attended the same school from preschool all the way through the eighth grade. So I definitely felt like that school was my school. Like, I had been there longer than most of the teachers had been there. So no, it wasn't hard at all. It's actually hard to do the opposite, to go from being in the school year and then jump back into being in a Black space again, because the switch was just so jarring.
You had several kind of transformational experiences. One of the ones is one that we've talked about before, when you took this trip down south, visited a plantation, and then also went to, was it a museum where they displayed photographs from lynchings and newspaper clippings?
It was. Yeah, it was a traveling museum. So I think it was at, I could get this wrong, but I think it was at like Jackson State maybe. But yeah, it was at a university, but it traveled around. So it was only at that university for a few weeks.
The traveling museum seemed to be really important and really, a truthful exhibit, but not so much with the plantation. The people working there were really apologists for the plantation and the things that had gone on there, tried to tell you that the slaves were happy and glad to be there.
Right.
And then that produced a lot of kind of turmoil between the students that were on that trip with you.
Whew. It was. I went on this trip three times. And that first time, I still just think about it like, oh my God. I can't believe any of that happened. So repeat the last part of your question again.
Well, I was just going to ask about your feelings about that and how it, the reaction between the white students on that trip and the
right. Yeah. To the plantation in particular.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that, that the Black students on that trip already had, a pretty deep knowledge about slavery in general, right? So we were aware of our own ancestors having been slaves. We, you know, our parents had talked to us about slavery. Like there was some knowledge going in, right? We knew about like spirituals, and we knew about slaves trying to run away and how they communicated, and you know, there was some knowledge that we were working with. And I think there were a lot of white students who just had never engaged with what slavery was, or how it impacted people who were slaves, or like there was just sort of an absence of information. And so as we walked around this plantation, Black students were becoming exceptionally angry as we realized that they weren't joking. And the white students, I think, were just confused because they're hearing a "it wasn't that bad" kind of story, but they're also watching their friends, their partners on this trip, become angrier and angrier and more emotional. And so I think for them, there was this sort of like tug of war, where they're like, this doesn't seem that bad, but also my partner seems to be becoming very, very emotional about what's happening here. And I don't get it. Like, I don't know what's happening. So there was like a real divide that was being created on that bus as we all sort of retreated to our own camps. So the longer the tour went, the more the Black students like started gathering together in the back of the line, like we started like almost like we're magnets, like just being drawn together. It was not pretty. It was not pretty. At the end of that little tour, the tour guides then announced that we could all go pick cotton on the plantation. And there was a minor eruption that happened. I'm not going to lie to you. It was like, I remember very specifically like pulling people away from the tour guides because they were ready to go off.
It seems like the white students were kind of just taking what the guides were saying as just history, that you know, these people seem to be experts on this plantation. So obviously they know how things were. When they say that the slaves were happy, they must know that they're experts in this.
Right, right. I mean, I'm sure, and the trip was sponsored by the university, like, right, like the university chose this plantation. So I don't think that was even unfounded. Like, I think there are good reasons why they were like, huh, okay. It's just that the Black students had a lot more information to work from and to work with. And we were genuinely shocked. Like, I really thought, so I remember walking into one of the shacks and there was a trough on the floor, and the tour guide pointed to the trough and said, now this is where slaves kept their babies. And this is much nicer than what other slaves had. And I was genuinely waiting for her to like crack a smile, to like this is like, this must be sarcasm. And she was serious. And so there was definitely a moment even for the Black students who were like, wait, is this happening? Like, is this really happening? Is that what they're saying? Are they really going to leave it at that? Like, we were having our own moment trying to process what was happening and whether or not it was a joke. And it wasn't.
Something else you alluded to is that I guess whoever was in charge of the trip paired you off with someone of a different race.
Right.
And I think you can understand what they were trying to do, But I think for people who've had these discussions, who've kind of been in this world for a while, know that the idea of just getting people together and talking about race without any kind of guide or someone who knows what they're talking about is not really a good idea. It's really setting people up for a really volatile situation.
And it was quite volatile. And you know, it's so hard because I think, so like I said, I went on this trip more than once. And the other ones lacked a lot of learning because there was no conflict. Mm. So in a strange way, it was actually helpful to witness the miseducation that was happening around slavery, because it forced all of us to recognize that there are very different narratives happening in America, even about African-American history.
Yeah.
So here we are trying to have this moment together, and we are witnessing racism and the apologetics and the romanticization of slavery. So in some ways it ultimately proved to be helpful, but in the moment, yeah, volatile is definitely the word I would use.
So after that, you became really active seeking racial justice on your campus and making sure the school hired and retained professors of color and teaching the white people around you. But then you started to see yourself as kind of existing for the sake of white people.
I did. So I learned the term racial reconciliation while I was in school. I don't know that that's a term I had ever heard before. But once I was in college, that started to be more a phrase that was used much more often. And I realized that I was really good at talking about race, I was good at saying hard things that that white people could still hear me, though, and could still engage with me. Which isn't to say that they didn't like yell back at me or anything, but 9 times out of 10, like if I really wanted to make a point, you know, folks would listen. And so I thought, maybe this is my calling. Maybe I have been called to the white people. And it was easy to find spaces to do that at a predominantly white college. So there were all kinds of like movies that we would show, or lectures that we would host, or just lots and lots of opportunities to engage white folks who were willing to be engaged. And so I really started to think, you know, maybe my calling is to help white people understand this. Maybe I was made for the white folks. And I have let that go. I was pretty convinced in college.
So I think some people listening would ask, what's wrong with that?
Yeah, because I'm just not here for basing my entire life around the needs of white folks. I think that day is done for me. Now, to be fair, there are folks who, people of color, who genuinely, like as an adult, having thought this through and prayed and lots of spiritual work, would say that they are called to white evangelicals or the white church or a white church, even if it's not like the white church, have been called to white spaces or white organizations. And so I don't say that as like, I truly mean me specifically. I don't feel like I have been called to white folks. But there are people who do, and who are brilliant at what they do. It's just not my story. It's just not my story. And that's not to say that I don't engage white folks. Obviously, I do that. But there has definitely been a shift in my mind about whether or not I have been created for white folks to get it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think of somebody I've gotten to know a little bit, Latasha Morrison, who's founded
yeah.
Bridge and is so good,
love
so
her.
Gifted. She was at our church this summer and just preached. And I was just like kind of in awe at just who she is and her ministry and just the grace that she has about her to do the kind of work that's required to do that.
Lord Jesus, God bless you, Latasha Morrison. the work that she's done amazes me for two reasons. One, because like you just identified, it does require a ton of grace to do what she does with white folks. And that alone is admirable. But two, I think what's really amazing about her work is that she has been able to connect white folks who are just starting out on this journey and are looking for places to have this conversation and to ask questions. She's been able to connect them with the people of color who want to be there to help white folks on their journey, right?
Yeah.
So they hop on like a Facebook group, for example, and white folks can say, hey, I saw this story in the news and I don't fully understand it. And a person of color who wants to, right, help unpack it, who wants to explain, can then hop on and say, oh, let me help you understand, or let me give you the context, or let me tell you about how this shows up in my life. And I think that is so beautiful, because there are so many people of color who do want to share their story and do want to be a part of that bridge building. But getting the two connected to each other can be really difficult, right? Like, so white folks should not just walk up to their coworker and be like, hey, do you want to build a bridge with me? You know, because that's not how it works. It can be hard to find those voices. And Latasha has closed that gap using social media and using community so that you could actually show up at a coffee shop together or whatever. I think it's amazing. I think what she has created is absolutely amazing. And if you haven't checked it out yet, you should.
Yeah. And I think that's such a great thing about the time that we live in, where people can, wherever they are, log on to a Facebook group and ask questions in good faith.
Yes.
And you're asking people who have had the agency to say, yes, I choose to engage in your questions. Right. And not be unwilling participants because you've decided.
Right. Yes, there is no power imbalance in the relationships that she's managed to foster online. People of color can choose to participate or not based on how they're feeling any day of the week, any moment. You know, they can disengage. And I think she's created some really good rules too. And I couldn't name them in particular, but you know, the fact that you have to like read the entire article, like real simple stuff, but stuff that needs to be said. Like you gotta read the whole thing before you jump in with a comment. You know, like she just has some really good rules for making sure that that community stays healthy and stays effective. Yeah, it's really brilliant what she's done.
So you spend a lot of the book talking about your life, your professional life. You've worked mostly in nonprofits that are predominantly white.
Yeah.
The whole time I was reading, I had flashbacks. Do you ever watch the TV show Insecure?
Oh, I love it. Yes.
I do too. I love that show so much. So the main character, Issa, works in a predominantly white nonprofit.
Right.
That predominantly serves children of color.
Right.
And the thing I like about that show is there's been other shows in the past that try to show kind of a black experience of going through maybe the workplace or academia or something. But most shows, it's usually peripheral character and the show's written by white people. And it kind of, it comes off as like a terrible like PSA.
I'm so with you. Yes. But
with Insecure, it is so natural. And you see these things take place and you're like, oh, that's happened. Like a writer on the show has had that situation happen to them because it's so natural. You know that that's taken place in real life.
One of my favorites, there are lots of favorite moments, but one of my favorites that my husband and I still say to each other on a very regular basis is when Issa, they had just had a conference meeting about something pertaining to the kids. And Issa walked into the like coffee room and it was all white folks standing around. And she picked up her cell phone and called her best friend. And she was like, they are having white people conversations. Like they're having secret white people meetings.
Yeah, it's tons of little moments like that.
Listen. Yes, and Black folks are like, yes, I have walked in on a secret white people meeting before. I know what that's like.
Yeah, there's so many good moments on that show. So, so you have had really similar experiences.
I have walked in on secret white people meetings.
Yes, for sure. Secret white people meetings. People approaching you around your place of work, asking if you need directions to the like food pantry, things like that.
Yep.
Have you really had your supervisor tell you that they've received notes that you're making people feel uncomfortable?
I have not. That was not a personal story for me, but it is the story of a girlfriend.
Yeah.
And she and I had to spend a lot of time figuring out how to communicate with her supervisor, both via email and then eventually, you know, in person. And I have had supervisors tell me like real vague things, like the team just isn't sure about your commitment here, or the team just isn't really sure, right? Like it's always those folks, but they're never named, and I never know when that secret white people meeting happened.
Yeah,
you know, I'm like, what meeting happened? Where was I when the team told you that they all feel one way about me? When was that? Was that in the cafeteria? Like, when did I miss a meeting? So yeah, it definitely happens in other ways, personally, in other ways.
I mean, I think I really, when I hear stories, especially about the workplace, to me, that's when the idea of white supremacy becomes most apparent in modern day, because there are all these rules that we've made up about how an office is supposed to function, how business is supposed to function, what hairstyles look professional.
Mm-hmm. That's a big one.
All of those things we just made up. There's nothing conducive to making an office a better place to conduct business. It's just something that white people made up at some point.
Right, right. And I think particularly, not just at Christian workplaces, but I think particularly at Christian workplaces, it becomes even easier to do because everything is wrapped up in what is holy and what is good, right? So like whiteness and like white professionalism, so to speak, is like one layer. But then when you add Christianity on top of it,
sure.
Things get really murky really fast. And it can be really difficult to like parse out all of those things. I wish I could come up with an example really fast.
I know that things can be cloaked in an air of spirituality, or I can use God to really push my own agenda. Like, you know,
right.
Austin, is this really a place God has for you? And what I mean is,
listen,
fitting into our culture.
If I could tell you how many times I have heard that, and it's kind of abusive because it really messes with your idea of God and your relationship with God, you know? So people say that and I'm like, God ain't said nothing to me. Like, I'm pretty sure God opened this door for me to come work here in the first place. Like, I don't understand. Is God telling you something that God isn't telling me? You know, like, it's really an unfair way to say what you really want to say, which is, I don't think you fit here.
Yeah. It's a really cowardly way to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I want to know, I want to ask this question and I want to be careful because I think often well-meaning white people will put this question out there, and that is the question of how to be a good ally.
Yeah.
Really, it should be something that white people should figure out. Like, we caused the problem. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I do wonder what it is that you, as a woman of color, need and want from your white brothers and sisters who care about you and care about the plight of people of color in this country and everywhere?
Man, that's such a good question. let me say this. One, I keep my white friends list pretty small. I have a lot of like white acquaintances. I have a lot of white supporters. I have a lot of partnerships, you know, in this work that I do. But friendship is like something wholly different for me. And I don't have, I have many white friends, but I have far more white supporters, white partners, white, right? Like the friendship list is the smallest of all of those. And I think there are a lot of white folks who think they're friends with people of color. Right.
Yeah.
I heard you get it immediately.
But, I mean, how many times have we heard, you know, I've got some of my best friends are black or something like that.
You know what I'm saying? And that might be One Direction, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
or more One Direction than the white person realizes. So I guess the first thing that comes to mind is going to be something that sounds backwards, which is that white folks can't rely on the friendship.
White folks can't rely on the friendship.
Yeah,
okay, because
white folks aren't very good at figuring out whether or not they're actually friends with black folks. So what happens is like, let's go back to this like coworker professional setting.
Yeah.
So a white person works with a black person, and the white person thinks that the black person is friends with, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But the black person would say, that's my coworker.
Sure. Right? Yeah, that's right.
But because the white person thinks that this is a friendship, the white person now feels that they have license to ask questions, to, you know, to make them their teacher any moment, to get really personal about, you know, the black person's background or home life or whatever. And now you've got a situation. Because the white person is soon going to get their feelings hurt. Because for the black person, this is a professional relationship, not a friendship.
And then there's this burden on the shoulders of that black person.
Right. Who now has to figure out how to navigate the white person's expectations for friendship, which is really awkward. Same thing with like the supervisor, you know, like if you're my supervisor, you're my supervisor. And until I say we're friends, we're probably not. Like you're probably just my supervisor. And I feel like white folks, when we talk about friendship, there's a disconnect because white folks are assuming they're friends with folks who would not say the same. And so I almost would prefer that white folks take a step back from the desire to have the friendship be the primary place of learning. I think white folks should invest in other ways of learning first, because those ways of learning are likely to lead to authentic relationships and authentic friendships. So what you're reading matters. So if I see a white person who is reading Ta-Nehisi Coates and then they post this upcoming book that I'm really interested in, and they attended a lecture, you know, from Latasha, yeah. And then they, you know what I mean? And then they went to go hear Christina Cleveland, and you know, like, then that says to me, oh, like we're interested in the same things. We're drawn to the same people. We're reading the same books, you know, like now we have some ground. Now we have, you know, a place to plant the seed and see if something grows. So I would say I would want white folks to take a step back, to be responsible for their own learning. And again, not exclusively so, not, you can't never talk to a black person. You know, I'm not trying to be extreme.
Sure, legally.
I just would prefer that white folks, yeah, don't chase after the friendship, because it really is, it turns the black person into an instrument. So you're not actually interested in friendship. You're really interested in your own learning. And that doesn't feel good, you know? And so make the book about learning, make Twitter about learning, make, you know, like make other places about learning and gathering and resourcing yourself, and then participate in really good conversation using all those resources with black folks. Does that make sense? Or other people of color?
I love that. And I also think that it works from the other end as well, because when people are reading those books and hearing those lectures, it will also help them to not see black people as a commodity to make themselves more, you know, less racist, or more just or whatever, but we see just the value in their humanity and who they are, and that they don't exist to educate us purely.
And I think it's really helpful for white folks who otherwise aren't in relationship with black folks, because they begin to be able to see those differences. So they can see the difference between Latasha's voice and my voice and Christina's voice.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
You know what I mean? Like they begin to see different expressions and to appreciate all those different expressions. And I think that's really important, because if I do become your friend, I need for you to not confuse me with Christina.
Oh, gosh.
I'm a different person.
And I think as well, you know, Fox News has made a cottage industry of finding the one black person who agrees with them and putting them in front of the camera. And I think the reason that works is because so many white people see black folks as a homogenous group.
Right.
And if you understand that people of color are as diverse as a bunch of white people, you understand that one does not speak for the entire group. And then, of course, of all the hundreds of thousands, the millions of black people in the U.S., of course, some are going to have a minority view on people. Of course they are.
Right.
But you can't see an entire group of people as one block.
Right.
And know that.
Yeah.
Well, I love that answer. Thank you. There's oftentimes, even as a white person, where if someone tries to engage me online and argue with me, don't talk to me until you've read the new.
Listen,
like, don't talk to me about criminal justice before you read
the
new Jim Crow.
Okay.
Or
that is so real, and I think that's what frustrates people of color, because some of these resources, one, have been out for a long ass time.
Yeah.
The New Jim Crow is not a new book. Like, if you have not read The New Jim Crow yet, I don't know what to say to you. Like, where are we going to start a conversation?
It's
read The New Jim Crow.
I go back to it. We live in this amazing time. You can download The New Jim Crow in 30 seconds from Amazon. You can go to YouTube and watch Christina Cleveland or Drew Hart or whoever, yourself. You can have all of these resources immediately and through, you know, very little work of your own, instead of going next door to the cubicle and asking the closest black person to you, who you've not earned the right to ask questions of yet.
Right. And I don't, it's, you know, you think about the fact that, one, there are so many books on so many different topics, right? So we just named The New Jim Crow on criminal justice, but we could name a million more on education or health or, you know, poverty or, you know, all the things. Right.
Absolutely.
But if it took an entire book, like it took the whole book of The New Jim Crow to be like, wow, all the things I didn't know, to expect a person to be able to deliver what's in that book.
Yeah, that's
and to be your personal teacher is deeply frustrating. That is really like if I had to read the book, I am a black woman. I care about the criminal justice system.
Yeah.
Michelle Alexander did not sit down in my living room and teach me about criminal justice. I had to go pick up the book. And if I had to go pick up the book, then you know what? I'm going to need for you to go pick up the book too.
Well, that was all so good, Austin. The book is so good. I rarely, I mean, almost never sit down and read a book in one sitting, but I read the entire book in one sitting.
And I'm so glad to hear that.
It was so good. So I hope that people check it out. Obviously, to everybody listening, I'll have links to the book on the show notes and links to Austin's website and anything else you might need. It'll all be there. So Austin, thank you so much for being back on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. But